Good evening and welcome to Your Legal Rights on KALW, 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Dean Johnson, sitting in tonight for your regular host, Jeff Hayden. I'm sure that some of you, like me, remember hooking up that big old first desktop and making your first connection with the internet. We were so full of hope. We were told that big tech was going to open up a window on the world, a forum for political debate, a personal space for free expression, a gateway to commerce without borders, and a wellspring of information for worldwide education. But it hasn't turned out that way, has it? The founders of big tech aren't kids working in their garages or college dorm rooms anymore. They're the wealthiest people in history, heads of corporations with more money and power than most countries. And big tech is being blamed for distorting everything from presidential elections to teenage body images. Tonight's topic, big tech, how it went wrong, how it affects you, and what can we do about it? As always, we want you to be part of this conversation, so give us a call. In the San Francisco Bay Area, the number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us on our dime at 866-798-8255. That toll-free number again, 866-798-8255. And please remember that our attorney guests and hosts are here to educate. But every case is different, and they cannot give advice about a particular case. Tonight, I'm really excited to have three outstanding guests with us. And let me tell you why. Our guest, Rob Reich, is a philosopher, the director of Stanford University's Center for Ethics and Society, co-director of the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society, and associate director of the Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. He is a leading thinker at the intersection of ethics and technology, the author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. He's a former sixth grade teacher who has won multiple teaching awards at Stanford. He helped to create the global movement hashtag Giving Tuesday, and he serves as the chair of its board. And Marin Sahami was recruited to Google in its startup days by the co-founder of Google, Sergey Brin. He's one of the inventors of email spam filtering technology. Thank you for that, Professor. With a background in machine learning and artificial intelligence, he returned to Stanford as a computer science professor in 2007 and now holds the James and Eleanor Cheeseborough Professorship in Engineering. As the Associate Chair for Education in the Computer Science Department, he helped redesign the program's undergraduate curriculum. He is one of the instructors of Stanford's massive introductory computer programming course, which is taken by nearly 1,500 students per year. Marin is also a limited partner in several VC funds and serves as an advisor to high-tech startups. And last but certainly not least, Jeremy M. Weinstein, a political scientist, went to Washington with President Obama in 2009. A key staffer in the White House, he foresaw how new technologies might remake the relationship between governments, citizens, and launched Obama's Open Government Partnership. When Samantha Power was appointed U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, she brought Jeremy to New York, first as her chief of staff and then as her deputy. Jeremy returned to Stanford in 2015 as a professor of political science, where he now leads Stanford Impact Labs, a major university initiative that partners research teams with leaders in public, private, and social sectors to tackle important social problems. He is a prize-winning author and a decorated teacher whose expertise spans both domestic politics and U.S. foreign policy. Rob, Marin, and Jeremy are collectively the authors of System Error, Where Big Tech Went Wrong and How We Can Reboot. And I'll just say as a personal note, I read this book in one sitting. It is a must read for anyone who's involved in big tech, which these days is everybody. Gentlemen, welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Really great to be here.
For having us, team.
You know, I always like to start our program with the big question and dive into the big issue first. And I note in the book that there was a character named John Perry Barlow who made multiple appearances during the book. And as we all know from the Bay Area, he was the lyricist for the Grateful Dead, but he was also one of the prophets of the internet. And in the early days of the internet, he pictured the internet and cyberspace as a kind of a libertarian utopia. But today, every time we turn on media, we're hearing big tech getting criticized for one social problem or another, whether it's presidential elections, teenage body images, invasions of privacy. So I guess the threshold question is, how did big tech go wrong? And what is it that they're doing that's so bad? And anybody jump in.
All right, this is Rob here. I'm going to jump in on that question. I mean, you started off by referencing John Perry Barlow. And of course, you're exactly right. The dreams of the early coders, the programmers, the visionaries that we all know the names of were utopian dreams, that technology was going to be a force that unleashed human creativity and capabilities, would spread democracy around the world, and would operate apart from all of our material problems in the actual world and of actual politics. And of course, that was false when John Perry Barlow wrote that, and it's even more false today. The problem of big tech at this point in time is that the very operating system of the entire industry is broken. It needs a reboot. And the idea that we have to communicate about that is nothing more complicated than the widely known facts at this point about how the cell phone on your table or in your pocket is a privacy abusing machine that sucks up vast majorities of all of your activity on the internet. The device sitting in your home, the Alexa device, the Siri device, whatever it happens to be, is a surveillance system for what happens in your home that also abuses your privacy. The algorithmic models that are at play in decision-making in every aspect of our lives are riddled with problems of bias and can't explain their decisions. And then, of course, the devices we use to communicate with each other, send messages into the wider world online, are also the same things that produce misinformation, disinformation, and amplified hate speech. And then finally, in the biggest picture of all, the great promise of creating machines that are as smart or smarter than humans is the trend line behind the displacement of enormous numbers of actual human beings from their jobs. The automation revolution might be increasing productivity, but it's coming at a short-term cost of leaving people without a material way to make money. And all of this under the banner of delivering a utopia. And that's why the operating system of tech is just fundamentally broken.
No, I want to get to each and every one of those problems. And I hope we have time to do that. But I've got to say, in reading the book, my first impression was one of deja vu all over again. I mean, shouldn't we have seen this coming? This sounds like the robber barons playbook. We remember the Fords, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers. They all started in their garages or their dorm rooms, wound up, you know, creating a transformative technology. Their economic power then translated into political power. They resisted any attempt at regulation of the negative effects of their tech. Distorted, you know, their enterprises all had what we economists term negative externalities, bad effects. I mean, shouldn't we have seen this coming?
So, you know, the three of us are privileged to teach on the Stanford campus, which birthed Silicon Valley in important ways, but has also been shaped in critical ways by Silicon Valley. And you know, over the last two decades, there's been an almost zeitgeist on campus, a sense that big tech and careers in big tech offered one the opportunity not only to change the world for the better, to make everyone better off, but to get fabulously wealthy at the same time, right? And that's not a perspective that we bring when we think about other industries, right? It was a part of the mythology of this liberatory moment associated with big tech. And you're absolutely right that the proper lens to bring to this most recent technological transformation is a lens informed by history, not Silicon Valley's ahistorical orientation to new developments, that you can't be constrained and shackled by the past in order to imagine a different future, but one that actually recognizes that the private sector can be an extraordinary engine of innovation and change, can be a driver of disruption that makes many people better off and maybe society on net better off. But there are lots of people who lose in the process. And Dean, you use the language of externalities to describe what Rob was talking about, that private sector behavior generates social consequences that affect large numbers of people well beyond the users of those technologies. And when economists generally think about externalities, they think about clean air or clean water. We think about an appropriate role for our public institutions in erecting guardrails around pollution to enable people to experience the benefits of the private market, but also be able to drink the water that comes out of their tap. That is the right lens to look at the consequences of big tech, a set of social externalities that are felt by all of us, regardless of whether we are users of these technologies. And in the absence of any guardrails from our political institutions, a regulatory oasis has been constructed around big tech so that the kinds of harms that Rob mentioned are now experienced at a scale of massive and significant proportions. And the last thing I'd say on this, Dean, is just you're absolutely right that we should have anticipated this, because we've seen this movie before, that there is a race between innovation and democracy, or between disruption and democracy, where changes that are brought about by the private sector leave our public sector institutions, and in particular our democratic institutions, struggling to keep up, struggling to erect the kinds of guardrails that are required. But the critical and optimistic thing that I can say today is that we're at the beginning of the opening of a policy window where our political institutions and our elected officials are now cognizant of these harms. They are not buying hook, line, and sinker the mission statements of companies that suggest this is all for the good and everyone does well. And so now, in addition to training our eye on companies, we need to focus our attention on our political institutions and our elected officials and hold them accountable for erecting some of the central guardrails that we need around tech.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought that it was a great coincidence that the Declaration of Independence and the Bible of Free Markets, the Wealth of Nations, came out the same year, 1776. And I think historically we've experienced that tension between democracy, equality, and liberty on the one hand, and innovation and free markets on the other. So do we view this kind of dance that we went through in the 19th and 20th century and more recently in the late 20th and 21st century as inevitable? Or is there some fundamental structural change that you envision that can help us anticipate those consequences before we start suffering from them?
Well, maybe the first thing I'd say on that is that it is the case that our political institutions serve a different purpose than the private market. Our political institutions, our democracy, in fact, is a technology that enables us to weigh competing values, to live together in a society where people have different preferences, different things that they want. And so ultimately, in that sense, our democratic institutions are constraining, and they're slow, and they're deliberate. They're trying to make sense of how we balance, as Rob mentioned, you know, privacy versus other goals that we might have in sharing our data, right? And that just being one example, how we balance free speech against protecting people from toxic harassment online, or guarding the quality of our public deliberation from misinformation and disinformation. So our democratic institutions are going to be deliberative and slow. That's a reality. But in a world in which that's true, there's also better that we can do. And what does better look like? Well, better looks like, in part, cultivating an ethic of responsibility among technologists and among the tech sector that incentivizes those companies to think about and explore potential social harms and ways to mitigate those social harms before technologies are rolled out at scale. And then the second thing that we need to do is we need to re-engineer our democratic institutions so that they have the kind of technical expertise that's required in order to peer into and look into these transformations that are happening in the tech sector and be in the business of moving far more quickly than they have in the past. So there's going to be work for everyone. There's work for technologists. There's building out this orientation towards responsible tech that is very much afoot in the present moment. But there's also ways of changing our political institutions to be far more responsive.
You know, Marin, I'd like to bring you into this conversation because I know you sit on the board of a number of venture capital firms. And full disclosure here, I took a course at Stanford. It helped me develop a startup. And by the way, my startup solves a lot of the problems we're talking about tonight. We can talk later. During the course and afterwards, I went through the venture capital process. I found the culture to be very sort of isolated and idiosyncratic. And when I was working recently with NBC, we covered the Elizabeth Holmes trial. And that crystallized a lot of my thoughts about venture capital. I mean, Elizabeth Holmes, her biopic is called The Dropout. She was a Stanford dropout. 19 years old, she was entrusted with nearly $1 billion and asked to produce technology that required a detailed knowledge of medicine beyond the state of the art engineering. And if the tech didn't work, a lot of people could die. And my question on TV was, gee, what could go wrong with that? My question for you, given that, and given that we seem to turn to college dropouts, to kids, to work these technological marvels. I mean, Bill Gates was a dropout. Steve Jobs was a dropout. Zuckerberg was a dropout. Is the venture capital process broken? Is it flawed? And should we be looking at that process as something we need to change?
Well, I do think there's problems with the venture capital process. I wouldn't necessarily say it's correlated with college dropouts in the same sense that I think some of the people who drop out of college drop out because they have their own motivation. Sometimes they are enticed by venture capitalists. But I think part of the underlying problem, and it's interesting to think about, is the venture capitalists, many of them are former engineers. What they're oftentimes interested in is looking at particular metrics for the growth of a business, how things are scaling up, what's the size of the market, what kind of engagement from the user base people are getting, and ultimately how big they think a business is going to be. And so a lot of this mindset to think about measuring these metrics, to look at these things projected forward, come from the standpoint of thinking about optimization. It's interesting if you actually look at the background of many of the successful venture capitalists today, many of them actually started out as engineers or with training in engineering. So they come from that particular viewpoint. And the problem with thinking about that optimization mindset, it brings up the question of what are you optimizing? The fact that the choice that you make for that thing that you are choosing to optimize is actually a value-laden choice. And so when we think about that notion, what we need to understand is what the choices that are being made by venture capitalists in terms of which companies they decide to fund, what kind of metrics they look at when they decide that they're going to fund companies, how they measure success going forward, are all, in fact, value choices that are being made. And part of those value choices, just to make this point a little bit more clear, is the notion of when you over-index on particular values, there are other values that get diminished. So, for example, someone could come along and say, I really care about privacy, say, as a value. And so I want to go fund a company that puts a heavy thumb on the scale of privacy. So I might want to fund a company that uses end-to-end encryption messaging, for example, to maintain privacy of those messages. Well, so the choice of doing that might seem like a personal choice because I'm thinking about revenue generation. But at the same time, when I make that choice, I need to understand that I have committed to a particular value that sits in tension with other values. So privacy might sound like a great value until we realize that the same people who might be using those end-to-end encrypted platforms also includes human traffickers and child pornographers and terrorists. And so when you think about it from that standpoint, other values come into play, values like national security, values like human dignity. And so the question becomes one of what are the values we care about? It's not just a particular technology that we're trying to promote, but the notion of the choices that get made in funding are in fact choices about values of what is worth funding. And unless those values are totally thought through and the tensions between the different values involved are actually considered, the choices that get made are actually not steeped in the values that they are indexing on. And that's where we see some of these externalities get generated.
And I want to talk about that further, but first, a word for our listeners. You are listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in the San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, our topic is big tech, how it went wrong, and what to do about it. Join our conversation at any time. Our phone number is 415-841-4134, or outside the Bay Area, 866-798-8255. As always, you don't have to jump in at the exact point that we are in on our conversation. Any questions within the topic are welcome, and we want you to be at this table as well. You know, gentlemen, I address this to you collectively. You talk a lot about the, and Marin has explained very well, the problem of the engineering mindset. And in the beginning of your book, you talk about two students, Aaron and Joshua, who I think really illustrate the problem. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This is Rob here. We chose to open the book with these little short profiles, vignettes, really, about the students we've encountered over the 20 years that we've collectively been teaching at Stanford. And these weren't students of ours, but they are the sort of people we've seen come through the university in the past 20 years. Aaron Swartz was a classic Stanford dropout. He was a kind of widely acknowledged prodigy in programming and computer science. Already as a teenager, he had created some important code that is now became a familiar part of the internet's very architecture. He was part of the founding of a company called Reddit. And the interesting thing about him, from our point of view, is that from his earliest days, he viewed the tools of computer science, the tools of being a technologist, as something to be deployed in the service of civic improvement, of a civic infrastructure, rather than as a means to make money in the first instance. And so his entire life was dedicated in many respects to thinking about technology as a force for liberation and collective action together. And 10 years later, roughly 15 years later, students like Joshua Browder came along, who found a way to use programming to solve very local and all things considered trivial problems with an eye toward an evangelical view about how it was improving the world. So Joshua Browder is a guy who in his high school years accumulated a whole bunch of parking tickets. And because he also had acquired programming skills, he created a little automated bot that would optimize the grievance procedure you could use to try to get out of paying parking tickets. And the company he then created is called Do Not Pay, donotpay.com. If anybody wants to take a look up, I'm sure he'd appreciate the free advertising here. And the basic idea behind the company is just to get you out of paying parking tickets and now other things that are automated along the way, without an eye toward the other things that we care about in assigning parking fines.
Not a good idea to give people an algorithm for beating their parking ticket.
That's right. And the algorithm can't distinguish between whether the ticket was legitimately or illegitimately issued. And even if it could, the basic idea that there are parking ticket reasons or justifications for having them, he just seems to have a clever hack to get out of doing something that's an irritation. And the civic spirit of Aaron Swartz and the like small and money-making spirit that dominated getting out of an irritation like paying a parking ticket that is symptomatic of a lot of the students that we see come out of Stanford and, you know, go get money in Silicon Valley for startup companies, is a marked change in the aspirations of technologists in Silicon Valley. You know, one other way to view this is that there's a shocking number of startup companies whose sole mission is dedicated to delivering lunch to other startup companies. Now, if what we were promised out of Silicon Valley was the genius of technologists trying to tackle difficult social problems, we do have some companies like that. We're not resolutely negative, but the kind of aspirations that are on offer for many people these days are for small things and for things that aren't even aware of the challenges in trying to solve them. Getting out of paying parking tickets is neither a hugely important problem, and even when it's successful, it upsets and disregards the other reasons we have for parking fines.
And Josh, our parking ticket guy, and Aaron met very different ends, did they not?
That's true. Josh is now the founder of this company, venture capital funded, called Do Not Pay, with growing ambitions. And Aaron Swartz had a very unhappy end. He took his own life a short number of years ago. I recommend people looking him up if you've never heard of him, Aaron Swartz, to learn more about him and his life. It was an extraordinary life.
Yeah. And of course, we have Elizabeth Holmes now very possibly going to prison. Very different ends. It is part of the problem. So as I understand it, I think what you're saying is that there are just some, you know, it's great to make things efficient. It's great to optimize something that used to be slow and mind-numbing, but there are just certain, there's certain irreducible kernel of human decision-making that shouldn't be tampered with. Have I kind of got that right?
That's definitely one element of the equation, but I'd take a half step back from that and say that what one needs to reckon with in the story of Josh Browder and Aaron Swartz and the challenges that Maron described around the optimization mindset is that a first order question is, what problem are you trying to solve? And is that problem that you're trying to solve important and consequential, and where the tools of optimization and efficiency are accomplishing important things in the world that are going to make people better off? But relatedly, in achieving that particular goal, and so we talked about the parking ticket example, but let's take the goal of empowering people's voices, which is what Twitter has done, or optimizing for connection, which is what Facebook has done. In achieving those goals, what potentially else is at stake, right? And of course, what the stories about the social media platforms reveal is that even if there's some fundamental goodness in your goal of fostering connection between people around the world, or creating a space in which people, regardless of their access to a broadcast network or a publisher, can break through those traditional gatekeepers and be heard, whether they want to be heard about Black Lives Matter or the Me Too movement, that the creation of those platforms is also in tension with other values. And that we have to think about those value tensions, not only from the perspective of the companies, but if the companies are not incentivized to weigh those trade-offs, who then steps into the breach? And I think the three of us in the teaching that we do and in the writing that we've done in this book believe that there's a central role for democracy for stepping into the breach, that our democratic institutions are the ones that set the guardrails in place.
And I'd like to follow up on that. I think that's one of our most important themes here. But first, let's take a break to have our station identify itself.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So we're back now. And Jeremy, you know, you talked about democracy, and democracy is a theme that runs through the book. And I think this is where one of the places where I do part company with the book. I almost fell off my chair when I saw that you titled a chapter, Democracy as a Guardrail. We just spent 4 weeks doing a multi-episode show called Are the Guardrails Coming Off? And the consensus among our listeners and our speakers, who included congressional candidates, was, yeah, the guardrails are coming off. So I wonder, can we really count on democracy to deal with these problems? In the past, we haven't done that well with anticipatory democracy. So what concretely can we do to guarantee, A, that democratic institutions are going to be there, and B, that they can deal with these problems?
So maybe a couple responses to that, Dean. The first is to say let's be very clear about what the alternative is to energizing and harnessing our democratic institutions to address these challenges. The alternative to doing that is to rely, as we have for the last 25 years, on leaders of tech companies to not only pursue their private interest, but also be attentive to the social harms that they're generating. And that is an approach to a hands-off approach to regulation, an embrace of almost a techno-libertarian orientation that has actually not served us terribly well. And so while I can understand the kind of concern that people have about the health of our democratic institutions, about the readiness of our democratic institutions to engage, I think you always have to be thinking about the alternative, right? And the alternative to reinvesting in our democratic institutions is a continued technocratic rule of this new technological age that we're in, which, for all the reasons that Rob outlined at the outset of the conversation, has generated extraordinary wealth concentrated in the hands of a small number of individuals and put a whole number of values that we care about at risk. So that's point number one. Point number two is to say that it's really easy to look at Washington, D.C., and say, democracy is broken. Nothing can get done in Congress. We have a level of polarization that we've never had historically. There's simply a lack of technical expertise. But I think that kind of critique is far too shallow and doesn't reflect the nuance of the moment that we're in as democracies begin to flex their muscles around the future of technology. First, look across the pond at Europe. Europe is 7 to 8 years ahead of the United States in thinking about issues like privacy and thinking about the accountability that needs to exist for algorithmic decision making and thinking about anti-competitive behavior. You referenced and referred back to the robber barons of the railroad era. These are things that Europe has been talking about for almost a decade, thinking very seriously about what the appropriate policy responses are. Alternatively, look up to Sacramento. Sacramento, seeing California as an environment in which so many of these large tech companies have taken root, has been thinking very hard about issues like privacy or the kinds of rights and obligations that we have to gig workers in the platform economy, the extent to which we need to think about accountability for algorithmic decision-making systems in the public sector. So we've got laboratories of experimentation with tech regulation that point us to a way forward. And just to rescue Washington from the caricature that people have in mind, we are probably at a moment right now with a level of bipartisan agreement around the concerns emanating from tech's concentrated power, around the kinds of harms that are being generated, which make possible progress on all sorts of low-hanging fruit related to tech regulation, whether it's federal privacy legislation, whether it's investments in education and upskilling to deal with the technological displacement of labor, whether it's ways of bringing accountability and transparency to algorithmic decision making. None of those issues generate the kind of partisan discord that we see around the role of platforms in regulating speech. And so we're at a moment where we see our political institutions tapping into the expertise that they need, generating legislative proposals, but we also see all sorts of other centers of power. So don't limit democracy to a perspective on Washington. Instead, think about democracy as the technology that we have for refereeing these value trade-offs and ensuring that our own collective interests are beginning to shape and influence the direction of tech in society.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about the quote from George Orwell, who was asked one time, how did the dystopia of 1984 get started? And he said, you know, it started when people stopped watching TV and TV started watching people. And that sounds an awful lot like the internet, and that sounds an awful lot like the kind of invasions of privacy, algorithmic decision making you're talking about. And we have that in the context of what's now being called a backsliding democracy. I mean, it almost sounds like, Rob, a recipe for 1984. I mean, shouldn't we be scared?
Sure. I mean, as we started off discussing, the operating system being broken, there are impossible to ignore harms that are the consequence of the digital revolution and the transformation powered chiefly by Silicon Valley companies. But I want to register here that despite the doom and gloom orientation of that diagnosis, we three in our teaching and in the book are actually quite optimistic. As Jeremy has already alluded to, the idea of democracy as a guardrail for avoiding the worst outcomes, the clear sense that in Washington, D.C. and in other places around the world, a policy window is now opening, the early grass shoots of an antitrust effort here in the United States, the regulatory efforts in Europe through GDPR and efforts to try to bring to bear new forms of regulatory attention to artificial intelligence and other frontier technologies. And I'll be honest, in teaching students now at Stanford University about these issues, no one needs persuading that there are difficult challenges. Everyone is aware of them. And the challenge is how now to find productive ways of confronting them. And democracy has a pretty good track record in that respect. It may not act quickly, it may not act optimally, but it does come to the fore in registering the concerns of citizens, a responsiveness to civic unrest, in order to try to at least install the minimal guardrails avoiding the worst outcomes. And, you know, it's dangerous to be a prognosticator, but I'll go on the record here and say that my bet is on our democratic institutions, despite the genuinely terrible shape that they're in today, over the next 10 to 20 years to rise to the challenge of putting in place sensible guardrails to ensure that we get the benefits of technology and avoid the worst outcomes.
You know, somehow I'm tempted to paraphrase Plato and say, well, who guards the guardrails? But we'll leave that for another day. You touched on some things that I think would be very interesting to our audience. One of the things that we hear in criticisms of big tech is invasions of privacy. And California is, as you said, somewhat ahead of the rest of the country in dealing with that. I'd like you to talk about two things. First of all, the invasions of privacy that we hear about go much deeper. In fact, you talked about the notice and choice system and how we give up so many rights that we don't realize. And then tell us a little bit about the story of Alistair McTaggart and how California got ahead of the curve. Miriam, could you give us a little summary there?
Sure. So California did get ahead of the curve by having this thing called the California Consumer Privacy Act, which was exactly and, you know, sat at the heart of trying to understand giving rights around privacy back to individuals in California. And the basic idea was that if individuals can have more ownership over their own data, they can have transparency into what data is gathered about them, have control about that data potentially being deleted if they don't like it, or being able to at least look at it so they can understand what data is collected, and then having some set of ownership around it, they would have in some sense a much stronger privacy guarantee for themselves. And so this law did actually go into effect, and it shows the fact, one, it's a shining example, actually, of how democracy in action can actually work. There was people who came together who saw that this was a problem. They acted collectively to create a ballot initiative. It got passed. It's now we need to see how it plays out in the courts, the way it's going to be challenged. But I think what you see here is a fundamental shift in where the power lies. Because if you listen to the story of big tech companies, what they would tell you is it's your responsibility to protect your privacy. It's your responsibility to set privacy settings in their applications. It's your responsibility to set the right settings in your web browser when you go on the web. It's your responsibility to use things like setting your cookie preferences in incognito mode if you're going to use that. And so what that means is they create a product that they say, you know what, our product may have these externalities. It might have these privacy implications, but we're not taking responsibility for it. You have to take responsibility. And what things like CCPA in California and the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, which predated by several years, actually say is, no, consumers have a right to their own privacy. That right needs to be taken seriously by these companies, and they need to worry about how to provide these privacy rights to individuals. And so to give you an analogy to make this more clear is if you went back, you know, a little more than 100 years ago to the advent of cars, we had cars driving around where we could have told people, you know what, get in your car and drive safely. And if you get in an accident, well, that's your responsibility. You need to guarantee safety. But other than that, there's no rules of the road. Well, what would have happened? And matter of fact, in the early days, that's what happened. There was lots of accidents. People died. So what did we get? We got a regulatory structure around driving that said, you know what, we're going to have roads, we're going to have lanes, you drive on the right side of the road, we put speed bumps around schools, you wear a safety belt in your car. Now, you still have your individual choices about how you drive, what kind of car you want to have, how fast you want to go, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a whole system of safety that's built around driving. That's the same idea with thinking about having regulatory guardrails for something like the internet. You can still make choices about what you want to do and where you want to go, and you have your personal choices you want to make around privacy, but there's a larger system of safety in place. And that's where things like CCPA and GDPR and other acronyms are actually pushing us toward.
So, you know, we hear about giving up privacy, but I think for a lot of us, that's very abstract. When we do what we all do, which is just check that little box saying we've read the terms of use and agreement and agree to them, we don't read them, but we're actually giving up quite a lot, aren't we?
That's absolutely right. I mean, most people want to use an app. They don't want to have to read through 35 pages of terms of service. Imagine every time you wanted to get in your car, you had to read through a bunch of terms of service for your car before you drove. Well, most of the time you just want to get somewhere. You want to get in your car and go. That's also true for people on the internet. They want to be able to get on the internet and use applications and get the benefits of it without having to suddenly be burdened with all these things that become their responsibility. That's why we need some regulation in place to shift that power balance.
Maybe one thing I'd add, Dean, is just to say this framework that we have now, which is called notice and consent, feels like a really good idea, right? Give us the freedom to make these choices and make sure that we're informed about the potential uses of you know, the data that we make available through these applications. But the problem is that there's a profound power asymmetry that exists in this relationship, and one that really puts the onus on individuals to be the most active privacy protectors if they have these concerns. But individuals, most individuals are not in a position to even understand the potential end uses of their data, much less to have the time and wherewithal to read through language that's presented in dense text at a moment where you really just want to access a map, where you really just want to download an application to order food. And so we're making it hugely difficult for individuals to effectuate their privacy preferences in the world. One of the things you find out when you ask individuals is that they have really strong commitments to privacy protection, but are deeply unaware of how their data is being used. And when they discover, they wish they were making different choices. So we haven't built an architecture that makes it possible for people to represent their privacy preferences in their behavior. And you could imagine, just as a hypothetical, a model in which companies needed to be responsive to individuals communicating their privacy preferences one time in a very simple way, right? As opposed to needing to create and repeat your privacy preferences application by application every time you go onto the internet. Instead, think about a simple 5 or 7 questions that an individual answers about whether they want their location tracked, about whether they want to share information not only about their own behavior, but anyone they're connected to on a social network. Think about those questions, ask people once, and then require companies that are engaging individuals on their applications to adhere to those centralized privacy settings. That would be something that's responsive to a concern for privacy, as opposed to a regulatory framework that's built in favor of the companies.
And part of the reason all of this data is being collected is that, at least with social media and the internet, data is the product, correct?
Well, data has tremendous value. And the reason why it has tremendous value is because it's now fed into machine learning or artificial intelligence algorithms that learn patterns based on that data. And so if you're building these kind of models to do things like predict what kind of content someone's likely to click on, or more from a monetization perspective, what ads someone's likely to click on, having that kind of data about their behavior, their preferences, their proclivities makes it more likely that you will be able to recommend or put something in front of them that they are more likely to click on, to read, to buy, whatever action you want them to take. And so at a large scale, that data has value. And part of the conundrum is that the data for any one individual isn't actually that valuable, but it's the fact that these large tech companies can basically aggregate huge volumes of data that gives it value with respect to making these predictions at scale.
And what they're really looking for is they want your attention. They want to know what attracts your attention and what's going to get your eyes looking at their service, their product, their social media network for the longest period of time, right?
Right. I mean, ultimately, what their goal is to have you engage with something that generates revenue for them, right? So advertising is the big one. And so in that sense, providing that data makes it more likely that they can put the right ad in front of you, which makes the advertiser happy because then you've engaged with what they want you to engage with. It makes the platform happy because the platform generates revenue. And so those incentives are aligned. They're just not necessarily aligned with the incentive of the consumer themselves.
And that's what leads to what we've sometimes called the silo effect. In other words, they keep feeding you the kind of things that they think you will like. So, for example, if you click on a Donald Trump campaign ad, you're going to start seeing a lot of Donald Trump and Donald Trump related stuff. And you're going to be sort of stuck in that silo. Yes.
Yes. And so that's one of the things, you know, some people call them filter bubbles. Sometimes it's seen or talked about as a cause for polarization, but is the fact that if you keep getting fed information that's like the other information you've seen before, you get a particular view of the world, which may be different than other people's view of the world. The other thing that comes up, and, you know, we can chat more about this, is that there's also particular kinds of information that people put out there, oftentimes misinformation that they want to dress up in a way to make it more likely for people to click on. And if they're successful in doing that, then what that means is that misinformation also gets recommended to more people and can pollute the information ecosystem.
And hence the proliferation of misinformation and disinformation and the constant drip, drip, drip that we see if we look into, say, the alt-right or, you know, certain types of political speech, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the reason why misinformation exists is because people engage with it and it changes people's behavior. And that's the, you know, if people were in some sense immune or could identify misinformation, then we wouldn't have a problem. The reason why we have a problem is people are actually swayed by it.
So, I remember one of my supervisors back when I was working in the government got really interested in the early days of the internet. He said, you know, now we have access to all the information in the world, but we have to teach people the judgment to distinguish between the good information and the bad information. Is the answer better education? I mean, should we be requiring everybody to take take courses in critical thinking or what?
Well, as the philosopher amongst the lot, I'm not going to say a negative word about taking classes in critical thinking. However, as a solution to the problem of information overload, echo chambers, filter bubbles, misinformation and disinformation and hate speech, critical thinking classes are emphatically not the answer. This is not something you put on the backs of K-12 education teachers to solve every social problem that exists. And we now lump this on top of it as well. Fine to do courses on that, but putting this on the back of teachers to convey a sensibility to school children and then to young adults about how to sort good from bad information is an abrogation of the responsibility of people who are in a better position to be editors, curators, to exercise professional judgment about quality and low quality information. So let's be clear here. The background problem, as you put it correctly, Dean, is that there is an ocean, a glut of information out there these days. We don't just go to the dictionary or the encyclopedia or the library. We have at our fingertips the world's information, a super abundance of information for us to sort through. So we need Google search in order to surface for us relevant information. Simply trolling the web or surfing the web is not going to work. We need algorithmic curation of our news feeds online. And that's because of the background superabundance of content. And of course, on the one hand, you can describe this superabundance of content as the consequence of everyone now having a voice. Everyone can put their own ideas into this new digitally mediated information ecosystem. There is something deeply important and impressive about that. But it also comes at a cost, that everyone's information is just as good as someone else's information. We've lost the capacity to have professional judgment and editorial professional norms that surface better from worse information. Let me give you just an example that comes to mind for me. Let's say that Jeremy has in mind to go, you know, bark into the universe about some very unusual, you know, concern of his. Maybe he's really worked up about the, you know, pest control in his local neighborhood. And he decides that he really wants to make an issue of this. And so he can go out in the street corner, fully in compliance with the First Amendment, and start yelling at anyone who drives by about the bad problem of pest control in the Bay Area. However, if he wants to do this online, if he's sufficiently clever about putting content up that goes viral, he can somehow now acquire, you know, thousands and even millions of viewers who engage with his content in a way in which what was initially just the exercise of free speech now becomes something that's a problem. As one of our colleagues at Stanford puts it, being on the internet is not a matter of your free speech rights. No one is entitled to freedom of reach on the internet. You only have freedom of speech. Go outside and talk all you want. That's your free speech right. No one is entitled to algorithmic amplification of what you say online. So critical thinking, fine. Do not make this a failure, however, of any ordinary person to do all of the work of surfacing bad from good information. We need to find ways to restore professional judgment, editorial curation, high quality from low quality information. Our information ecosystem is polluted with the muck of everyone speaking at once in a jumble of voices and no way to sort through it except algorithms which are not trained or tuned in order to surface bad from good information, but rather, as Maron explained, to optimize for engagement with the information.
And let's be clear about that last point, Dean, because I think we just need to lift it up for your audience, which is things don't just go viral. Right? That the process of algorithmic amplification that underlies the social media platforms is a choice. It's a choice and the fine tuning of a set of technologies by tech companies that are optimizing for profit, that are optimizing for revenue growth. And so when we see these consequences of the promotion of misinformation and disinformation, the cultivation of filter bubbles and echo chambers, it's because algorithmic curation is happening. But it's happening to enrich those who run the social media platforms and without attention to the consequences for our democracy.
Well, you know, we could continue. This discussion alone could occupy easily an hour or more. But we're, believe it or not, about out of time. And we've got three people here who've spent their lives studying the interface between big tech and democracy and capitalism and our own private lives. And I'd like to give each of you about a minute to tell our audience the one thing that you would like them to know about big tech and what they can do to protect themselves in a society where big tech is prevalent.
Maybe I'll start by...
Jeremy, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start by saying people occupy lots of different professional roles in their lives. Some people who are listening may be working in tech. Some may be investors. Some people may be working in environments where they simply use and take advantage of new technology products. But the one thing that unites everyone who's listening to this show is that you are a citizen of somewhere. You're a citizen of a political community. Many will be citizens of the United States. Others will be citizens of other political communities. And I think our view and our optimistic orientation is that this is a moment. We're entering a moment where activating your sense of agency as a citizen is what's key to generate the kind of technological future that we need. And so there are lots of things that you can do to protect yourself, but the orientation that we want people to have is toward some of the social consequences of tech that require us to activate ourselves collectively.
Rob, what do you want? What would you like our listeners to know?
Well, I'm going to continue with the theme from before, which is don't fall for the old idea that everything is on you to figure out. We have to engage collectively here. So if, for example, someone says to you, well, if you don't like Facebook or you don't like Twitter or you don't like Google, just stop using it. Get off the internet. That's a ridiculous response to the idea of, you know, being engaged in the modern world. We need to engage as citizens in collective solutions rather than as individuals monitoring our own devices as the solution to these large system scale problems.
Merrim, close us out here. What would you like our listeners to know?
Well, as an educator, the one thing I always come back to, I think it's important for people to understand and educate themselves about the things they care about so they can make value judgments for themselves and for their families that matter. So at the end of the day, you know, it's easy to write things off and say you don't have any power, that technology is just going to happen to you and you have to go along with it. Technology is not some monolith that is faceless. It's a collection of people who respond to the needs of other people, whether that's asserted through product choices you make, particular kinds of preferences you set, or as Jeremy said, how you vote. So you have more power than you think. Don't lose sight of that agency, but just take some time to educate yourself so you can make decisions about the values that really matter to you.
You know, this has been a terrific discussion. We haven't even scratched the surface of this huge topic and a vitally important topic for our listeners here in the Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. I hope we can have you guys back again sometime soon and just continue this discussion. And on a personal note for myself, we've all been watching the events in the Ukraine. We've been listening to this discussion today. I think the world is kind of trying to teach us a lesson, which is that we always talk about your legal rights, and that's the theme of this show. But you've got to get out and fight for your legal rights if you want to continue to have your legal rights. So thank you all for coming. For our listeners, the book is System Error, Where Big Tech Went Wrong and How We Can Reboot. Recommended reading for everyone. And you've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, where we have been discussing big tech and the law and where we went wrong. The show was produced by Jeff Hayden and me. Joanne Marr was at the controls. And for all of us, this is Dean Johnson saying good night, stay safe, stay healthy, and see you next week.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.